Invention by some scientist has caught up to everyone, including people who say in the White House that it is an important issue that humanity has got to grapple with. Actually, I think in October, there is what we think is an important meeting in Washington that is convened by the United States President, which we think might present a new perspective, a new commitment by the U.S. on issues on the question of the machine itself. It's a very important challenge. It's particularly important for us in the South, in developing countries, because we cannot be completely held responsible for the problem of climate change, because the people need to do. Some people think. But at the same time, however, we cannot say that we didn't burn the house, so it was a burned down. It was not responsible for it. We all have got to play a role in addressing this. So we're hoping that the presentation today will talk to some of these important policy challenges in this regard. We've got with us John Ellis and his team. Maybe you can introduce the people with you to them, and then you can take us through the presentation. Before that, there is a document that was, I think it could remain with LG, but I think definitely we want to circulate to the press, because there's further work that needs to be done to see. There are specific gaps and omissions in the document, but I think the members of parliament can help with that. But we want to share it today on in the members.
Okay, and thank you. The gaps and omissions are in the presentation, and we'll circulate copies of the presentation. Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'm accompanied by Judy Beaumont from DEEP, and also at the back by Dr. Papaya from the Weather Services and his colleagues. Before we go into the presentation, if I can just talk briefly to two things. Firstly, what we are going to be dealing with today, and then secondly, to just talk a little bit about how we manage climate change within, with not only within government, but within South African society more broadly. The presentation that we've done, Honourable Chair, includes quite a lot of information from the Weather Services. So we've also worked from Sandy, so we've consolidated it into one presentation. But the colleagues from the Weather Services are here and will answer questions, and you can, if necessary, then could elaborate on anything that anybody wants to ask them. And so it is, and the presentation is a fairly comprehensive presentation that looks at the issues related to climate change and the science around climate change. It looks at issues related to the international negotiations around climate change. It looks briefly at the work that we're doing at a country around climate mitigation as a fairly comprehensive picture. But I thought that before we start, in order to put that in a context, we should explain that within government, the way that we manage our work around climate change is through a number of structures, and I'd like to just outline those. The first is that there is an inter-ministerial committee on climate change that consists, there's a core group of ministers, and then there's a broader grouping of ministers who consider this to be an issue of relevance to themselves, and the meetings that have happened of that inter-ministerial committee have been extremely well attended. So quite a lot of the decisions in cabinet that are taken on climate change are first processed through that interministerial committee on climate change. Secondly, that is then supported obviously by a committee of senior officials who do the preparatory work for it. But then I think most significantly, we have a national committee on climate change, and that is a multi-stakeholder body. It consists of all the government departments that do work on climate change, including representatives from provincial and local governments. It also has representatives from industry and from business. Business Unity South Africa is represented there. ESCOM is a member of that structure. It also has representatives of all the different science bodies that do work on climate change. So weather services, the South African National Biodiversity Institute, the CSIRO, wide range of scientific organizations as well as individual academics participate in the work of the NCCC. And then there are quite a large number of civil society organizations, including organizations like Earth Life Africa and the South African Climate Action Network and SANCO and COSATU also all participate. So I think that really we do have this broad-based forum that does work as a coordination forum. So there are particular areas of work that are done either by different line departments or by working groups, and that work then gets reported, and this forum acts as a kind of a clearinghouse. All of the work that we do around climate and the decisions or the recommendations that are going to be taken further are then brought and debated within that forum. So I thought that really we should, because I think that one of the important things about South Africa is that for a small country, we actually have, I think, quite a high level of national consensus around the importance of the issue and the need to deal with it. And our forum has grown from probably had about a participation of about 70 people, whereas it was probably about 20 or 50 a year or 18 months ago. So I think that really at a broader level in society is obviously an issue that is seen as more and more important. So I think that with that then as a background, I'd like to hand over to Judy to take us through the presentation. She'll do the first part of it, and then right at the end, I will talk about our long-term mitigation scenario planning process. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning to everybody. Can people see the presentation with the lighting as it is? Would it be worth perhaps trying to turn off the lights on this side? Oh, you've got them on. Oh, great. Thank you. Well, Joanne has just introduced what we're going to do in the presentation. But just before we get into...
It's coming in paper.
Just before we get into some of the questions of the impact of climate change and some of the international negotiation processes, I thought it would be useful just to briefly remind ourselves exactly how the greenhouse effects work. And essentially, in a world in which there's not an overabundance of greenhouse gases, you'll find that most of the radiation is either absorbed by the Earth's surface, and if not, it escapes into the atmosphere. But with a blanket of greenhouse gases covering or in our atmosphere, a lot of that infrared radiation is emitted back to the Earth's surface, and so you have temperature rising. And a lot of the data now, going back from 1860 all the way to 2000, is showing a rapid increase in carbon dioxide concentrations. This is not new to anyone. It's just useful sometimes to see the diagram. Also, data is showing us increased global surface temperatures from 1860 through to 2000, and particularly by roughly 0.6 degrees during the 1900s. From from a context perspective, although South Africa emits only 2% of global emissions, our challenge is that we have incredibly heavy reliance on coal to meet our energy needs. 75% of total energy consumption in 2005 came from coal. We're the 11th highest emitter after China and India in the developing world. We're the largest contributor to greenhouse gas emissions in Africa. And Sasol's Secunda plant is often cited as being the largest single source of greenhouse gas emissions in the world. So we're not doing too well. And although we may not emit much greenhouse gas when our emissions are divided by our population, we are a very greenhouse gas intensive economy. In other words, we emit far more greenhouse gases than many other countries in order to produce our products. So we have a lot of energy wastage. And here you can see in this graph, which shows South Africa in yellow, the US in pink, and India in blue. And this graph basically shows you the metric tons of CO2 that are emitted per $1,000 of GDP, and South Africa is the highest there. This shows you roughly the top 25 and how they are structured in relation to intensity, carbon emissions intensity, just the basic top 25 emitters, and top 25 per population. And you can see there that South Africa sits both within the category of top 25 in terms of very emissions intensive GDP, and then within the top 25 of just pure straight quantity of emissions. And you can see that in the center there is US, China, EU, Russia, India, Japan, Germany, Brazil, UK, etc. Just in terms of how our greenhouse gas emissions are broken down by sector, these figures are in 2000. And you can see that roughly we are quite similar to the world breakdown, but have a look at the red section, which is electricity and heat, and you can see that a huge percentage of our emissions comes from electricity and heating. Large percentage from manufacturing and construction, then down to transportation, other fuel combustion, fugitive emissions, and you can see there industrial processes, agriculture, and waste. Agriculture having quite high emissions as well. Having a look at our global projected rainfall changes, you can see there that a reduction in rainfall there is reflected in red. This is probably quite difficult to see, it's quite small, but if you look at South Africa, on the left-hand side there, you see the December, January, February, and on the right-hand side, you see June, July, August, and you see for southern part of Africa, South Africa, quite enormous changes. From a temperature perspective, on the left-hand side, you see from 2020 to 2029, and on the right-hand side, you see from 2090 to 2099. And below is the indication of the change, temperature changes from basically 4 degrees is the bright red. And you can see there that the entire globe is affected by major temperature changes from the year 2090 to 2099, but it's already starting to be reflected from 2020. Coming a bit closer to home, in South Africa, the projected rainfall change. On the left-hand side is July, on the July period, and on the right-hand side is the December period. Once again, there you see the red coloring is significant reduction in rainfall. Going up to the blue coloring is an increase, and you can see there that the Western Cape is in trouble, particularly in the July time. looking at rainfall and temperature change. Now this basically is measured in terms of soil moisture, so it's the interaction between temperature and rainfall. And you can see there that the red indicates very favorable soil moisture, and it's about the number of days per year, so red equals 0 to 20 days per year of good soil moisture. And going less red to the yellow is an increasing number of days of soil moisture. And you can see in the bottom map that in 2050 we have significantly reduced numbers of days of favorable soil moisture. Then just turning briefly to some of the impacts. Now, from an agricultural perspective, looking at the agribusinesses that are at highest risk, it's those that are really stressed economically and or biophysically. It's those that are at a threshold or close to their threshold of climate tolerance. So, for example, apples, which require very cold temperatures in winter. It's emerging and other farmers who may have limited capacity, resources, and skills to adapt and withstand economic pressures. Rural livelihoods who depend on agribusiness-based economic activity. Commercial farmers with significant long-term investment, and agribusiness that is dependent on the export market, which is adapting to climate change in itself. If you look at the whole question of health, this is a map that shows you the potential for increases in malaria distribution. The top map shows what it is current, well, that was in 2000. The bottom map shows what it could be in 2020. The population at high risk is projected to quadruple by 2020 to 36 million, including in many parts of Gauteng. And it's expected that this, the total cost of increased malaria are significant and could be between 0.1 and 0.2% of GDP by 2020. So that red section in the lower map indicates the potential expansion of malaria. From the perspective of biodiversity, some of the indicators are that there's going to be significant shifts in major vegetation types or biomes, that there are likely to be significant negative effects on the home range size and species richness across almost all animal and plant groups, and that current conservation areas and their capacity to support species will be challenged, particularly because there's these changes and shifts in the home range. Here, if you look at this map, this is a map just to give an indication of those potential shifts in vegetation boundaries. If you look at the top left-hand map, that shows what it is currently. And I'll just give you an indication that the green is grassland. The darkish yellow is The yellow is savanna. The darkish yellow is Nama Karoo. The red is Sangor. And the brownish color is succulent Karoo. And if you look at the three maps, those are different types of modeling approaches, but each of those different modeling approaches have shown, firstly, you can see quite a significant reduction in grassland. A significant reduction in savanna, reduction in Nama Karoo, significant reduction in Sangor. Basically, just a pointer towards what it could mean for South Africa's biodiversity. Here's a map of biodiversity of bird species richness patterns. The top map shows current species richness. And the bottom map shows what it could be in 2020. And there you can see the dark blue gives you a high level of species richness. And going to lighter colors is a lower level of species richness. So quite a significant reduction in species richness. From a marine biodiversity perspective, there's an expectation that there would be significant and serious effects on estuary health because of reductions in catchment runoff estuaries require strong catchment runoff in order to remain healthy. Significant and serious effects on coastal species and coastal habitats. There's been some work and results of scientific work done on changes that have already occurred in the marine ecosystem, and these are indicating that there's likely to be a change in distribution of some of the economically important fisheries, and that there has been an indication of that in some of the press recently. So that gives a sense of what the potential impacts are for South Africa, well, first globally and then South Africa. Now what I'd like to do is move on to some of the important work that has been done and has produced results recently, both from an economic perspective and from a science perspective. Now, towards the end of last year, the press had quite a lot on what was called the Stern Review, which was a piece of work done by an economist for the United Kingdom. And really, what the Stern Review said in 3 points, it's a very fat document and it's got a lot of economics in it, but in a nutshell, what it says is that with no action, the cost is likely to be the equivalent of losing at least 5% of global GDP each year. And this could rise as high as 20% of global GDP. In contrast, the cost of action, in other words, reducing greenhouse gas emissions to avoid the worst impacts of climate change, could be as low as 1% of global GDP each year. And finally, that the investment in the next 10 or 20 years will have a profound effect on climate in the second half of the century and in the next century. And that is because the technology choices that are made now lock in a particular form of resource use or emission intensity of emissions for now up to 20, 30, 40 years. The significance really of that Stern Review was that it was the first pure study on the economics, the global economics of climate change, and that's why it actually created quite, or it stimulated a lot of interest. The second area, or the second important outcomes that have been in the press lately this year, have been the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC for short. Now, the Intergovernmental Panel has 3 working groups. The first working group focuses on the actual science of climate change. The second working group deals with the impacts of climate change. And the third working group deals with emissions and how to technology options and choices for reducing emissions. Now, working with Group 1 produced its results in February this year, and its major message out of thousands of pages of research done by the world's top climate change scientists are that observed and predicted future trends of changing climate are unequivocal, and that with 90% certainty are caused by human socioeconomic activity. Now, this is quite significant because the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has been working since 1990. And the results of their work in 1990 were that it would probably not be possible to say for certain that that indeed there is a warming trend and that indeed that warming is due to human activity. So this is the first time that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has been able to say unequivocally and with 90% certainty that warming is taking place and that it's due to human activity. Working Group 2, as I said, focuses on the impact, and its major message, again out of thousands of pages of research, is that the impacts are more imminent and severe than previously thought. And that between 2050 and 2100, the impact could be disastrous. It also confirms Africa's particular vulnerability, both because of multiple stressors and also because of our low capacity to adapt. as a continent. Working Group 3, as I said, focuses on emissions and technology for dealing with those emissions, and its major message is that existing and new technology can solve the problem at a cost that is affordable. And in fact, the Working Group 3 results said that the cost would be between 1 and 3% of global GDP. So there is a coherence there with what the Stern Review produced. Now, turning now briefly to the international negotiations. As you know, the international negotiations take place under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change and its Kyoto Protocol. And the Kyoto Protocol basically sets emission reduction targets for developed countries, and the first commitment period under the Kyoto Protocol runs for from 2008 to 2012. So a big focus of the work in the international negotiations is around looking at more ambitious emissions reduction commitments for developed countries. Currently, in terms of the political dynamics at a global level, there is a deadlock. And it has been this way for a while. The United States, as the largest emitter, which of course, as you know, has not signed up to Kyoto, says that the Kyoto targets are unrealistic and will compromise the U.S. economy. They also say that developing countries, large emitters, China, India, Brazil, etc., must take on binding targets. And the U.S. is indicating that they would not move without developing countries, large emitters, taking on binding targets. The European Union and other Annex I countries, as they are called, other developed countries, want the USA to be bound by emissions reduction targets because their industry is economically and competitively disadvantaged by the US hanging up. And they want, the EU and other developed countries want to secure and need, in fact, to secure and grow the carbon market, having invested extensively in the carbon market. The Group of 77 and China, which is the bloc, the negotiating bloc that constituted of all the developing countries, its line is that the historical responsibility for climate change and for high levels of emissions is the developed and industrialized world. And its priorities, the priorities of members of the Group of 77 are poverty eradication, economic growth, and development. And the Group of 77 is also a very complex group. It's made out of many countries with different economic objectives. So there's quite a division within the Group of 77, for example, between OPEC or oil-producing countries and other countries and others, for example, Africa, least developed countries, and small island developing states, which are very concerned about support for adaptation and are in particular going to be most affected by climate change and therefore need to take the greatest action to adapt to climate change. So, looking briefly at where the international negotiations are at the moment, going back a little to December 2005, that was the 11th Conference of Parties, which took place in Montreal. At Montreal, in order to try to break this deadlock, a two-track process was set up. And the first part of that was called the Kyoto Track, and that part of the negotiation was focused on stricter emission targets for developed countries, for the industrialized countries, and most in particular focused on how to ensure that the second commitment period, how to ensure that there's no gap between the first commitment period that ends in 2012 and the second commitment period for developed countries, developed industrialized countries. The second track is called the convention track, and that really is a dialogue, not negotiation, but a dialogue under the convention. And it's a dialogue focused on long-term cooperative action, and it looks in particular at what kind of action developing countries can take, what kind of commitments and what kind of action developing countries could undertake. Now, the 12th Conference of Parties, which followed the Montreal meeting, took place in December last year, 2006, and it took place in Nairobi. I think there was quite a lot of information in the press. It was important for Africa because it was the Conference of Parties, was in fact the African Conference of Parties. And effectively, there was momentum that was maintained in Nairobi on both of those tracks, the Kyoto track and the convention track. There were no major breakthroughs, but there was a maintenance of momentum. Then in May this year, in Bonn, the what is called the subsidiary bodies. Now, in essence, the subsidiary bodies are the negotiations that prepare for the next Conference of Parties, which takes place in December. So you can get a sense that the Conference of Parties takes place once a year, and it takes place in December each year. So it went Montreal, Nairobi, and the next one is taking place in Bali in December this year. And the subsidiary bodies in May, preparing for the Bali meeting, agreed to develop a timetable in order to ensure that there is no gap between the first and second commitment period under the Kyoto Protocol. And what was quite significant at that meeting was that South Africa and Brazil started working to shift the discussions in the dialogue, which are at this stage merely discussions around the kinds of actions and commitments that developing countries could take, towards negotiations. So trying to bring some kind of a, get some kind of a movement between what is happening under the Kyoto Protocol and what is happening under the Convention. The second other important area of work in the international negotiations is on adaptation. Now, under the UNFCCC, adaptation has been discussed in a very piecemeal and fragmented way. The focus has been on mitigation. And adaptation has really not received the emphasis and weight. And South Africa, in fact, Africa's position here has been that there must be balanced emphasis on mitigation and adaptation, and there must be focus on implementation of adaptation programs. It's too late to be talking. We actually now need support from technological support, financial support, etc., for implementation of adaptation programs. Very importantly here under adaptation, there was a breakthrough in COP12 after years of negotiation around a five-year program of work on adaptation, which is the first time that there is now a coherent focus on scientific, technological work for adaptation in the international negotiations. A third large area of work is in brief called response measures, and in effect this talks about what needs to be done in order to manage the unintended consequences of mitigation policies, particularly on those oil-producing countries. You would have seen that there's been quite a lot in the press recently about the USA. Now, essentially, just before the G8 meeting in June, President Bush made an announcement, and he called on the 15 largest emitters to set goals for reducing emissions by the end of 2008. And of course, the 15 largest emitters include a number of developing countries, the obvious being India, China, Brazil, but South Africa, in fact, falls under that as well. And then just looking at what happened at the G8 meeting in Heiligendamm in June this year, this was an important meeting. It was chaired by Germany, as you know, and it was an important meeting. The EU had in fact sent out a signal that the EU was aiming for a 20-30% reduction of emissions based on 1990 levels by 2020. And it was important for the EU to try to get some kind of an agreement which would send a positive signal. Sometimes an agreement at a G8 meeting that would send out a positive signal. all they really got, and it is to some extent a positive signal, was that the G8 countries would consider a 50% reduction by 2050, and that is based on the current levels of emissions and not the 1990 emissions levels, which are obviously lower. The G8 also agreed, close to finish, and the maps, most of the colourful versions are already passed, so you're not going to lose on that. So effectively, the G8 did send a positive signal in terms of there was an agreement which included the US that there would be a target of 50% reduction by 2050, that the major economies should join in on this process, that the UN is an appropriate forum and is the appropriate forum for negotiations to take place, and that there would be a two-step process. First, that the major economies would agree on targets by 2008, and that this would move towards a global agreement, sorry, that's supposed to be 2009, not 2000. And the G8 also welcomed the US offer. Now, just to mention that from South Africa's perspective, while the US announcement, while President Bush's announcement was indeed an important signal from the US, from our perspective, it really is essentially largely a repackaging of the existing approach of the US. And the important thing is that we do not want ambiguity in terms of where those negotiations must happen. Those negotiations must happen within the UN. It must be a multilateral process. It must happen under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change and Protocol. And it must not be an initiative that diverts attention and stops another new process. There was also an important meeting following the G8, which was a Sweden ministerial meeting. You'll recall that last year South Africa hosted the ministerial meeting at Kapama. And really, that process has been a process of trying to get some kind of a high-level political agreement on what the key elements of the package might be outside of international negotiations. And there was some progress at that Sweden ministerial. South Africa was very active at that meeting. And in fact, the chair summary from that ministerial meeting in Sweden, which was just 6 weeks ago, has many of the elements of what South Africa believes to achieve their package deal, and I'll come back to that shortly. Another important initiative is the UN Secretary General's initiative of a high-level meeting on climate change, which is scheduled for September this year. South Africa has received an invitation. Once again, that is also about airing the option for some kind of a deal, and it precedes the 13th Conference of Partners in Bali. There are a number of other preparatory meetings that will take place between now and December, and South Africa will be participating actively. Just looking then at some of the considerations, if one to analyze or ask the question, so where are we currently in the international negotiations? Really, the truth of the matter is that despite what happened at the G8, there is the key members of the G8 members are still far apart. The EU is talking about reductions below 1990 levels, whereas Canada and Japan are talking about 50% reduction below current levels, and the US is saying that they might consider 50% reduction, but they're being very vague about it. There are very complex dynamics within the Group of 77 and China. And it impacts on South Africa's positioning and our bridge-building role. South Africa has been playing quite an important role in the international negotiations. Firstly, we are coordinating the Group of 77 position in the negotiations under the Kyoto Track, which is the negotiations dealing with more ambitious commitments for developed countries. So we are the G77 coordinator in that process. And we are also co-chairing the dialogue, which I mentioned earlier, the dialogue on long-term cooperative action, which looks at actions and commitments by developing countries. So it's important that we maintain our so-called neutral and facilitating role. Now, some of the dynamics which have taken place recently, which are affecting the space within which we have to maneuver, are, for example, just after the G8 meeting, as you know, the G8 plus 5, the outreach 5, which includes China, India, Brazil, South Africa, and Mexico. The China and India started withdrawing after that meeting, and there was a process problem there in which the G8 statement was in fact issued before Germany had managed to consult with the outreach 5 members on what the statement exactly would say, and this certain, particularly with India, gave a sense of a lack of good faith in the process. And so since then, Germany has been engaging in a lot of diplomatic work to try to get India and China back on stream. But there have been a couple of indications in the press in which India in particular has said, we are absolutely not interested in taking on any kind of commitment, with emissions reduction commitment. Our objective is 8% growth. That's where we stand. Historical responsibility is the developed countries, and we wait for developed countries to take the lead. And that really has been a position that's a very hardline position from India a while ago, and it appears that they have retreated back to quite a hardline position in that respect. Another dynamic here is that Brazil, South Africa and Brazil have been working very closely, and Brazil has actually said that they are distancing themselves from the position that China and India are taking, and Brazil has indicated that they are open to discussions and probably negotiations on what sorts of commitments and actions developing countries should be taking. The other complexity within the Group of 77 in China, as I've said, is that there are multiple countries, all with differing development objectives, and this plays itself out in particular between the OPEC oil producing countries and other countries that are mostly concerned about adaptation, in particular Africa, least developing, least LDCs, and the small island developing states. So what is South Africa's position for the meetings coming up? Really, our starting point is that the multilateral process must prevail, that the President Bush's initiative must not take us away, must not divert from the multilateral process, that the pace of negotiations must catch up with the urgency that is indicated by science. And I don't think I need to say anything about that, particularly from an African perspective, which as we've seen is going to be very significantly impacted. So what do we see as the potential elements of a package deal here? And really here are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 elements that would have to be very delicately balanced in order to get agreement from all parties concerned. Firstly is adaptation, an emphasis on adaptation, standard African position. Secondly, that there must be more ambitious targets for developed countries, that DC stands for developed countries. Secondly, there must be enhanced mitigation action by developing countries. We need to strengthen the carbon market. There must be technology development and diffusion. There must be action on deforestation, and we must find a way of managing the unintended consequences of adaptation and mitigation policies. I think at this stage I'm going to hand over to Joanne, who's going to tell you about the long-term mitigation scenario.
Thank you. And maybe to move from the international back into the national, I mean, I think that what Judy has been talking about is very much being thrust to South Africa's position over the last few years in the international negotiations. This consistent, that last slide is consistently what we've been saying as a country. In that, what we said is that we think that developed countries must take on further commitments, and that they really do bear the major burden of this problem. But we agree that developing countries, that everybody's got to take up what's called their common but differentiated responsibilities. And so as a country that does emit greenhouse gases, we need to be also looking not only at adaptation to the impacts of climate change, but also starting to look at what could we do as a country to mitigate our greenhouse gas emissions. And the next part of this presentation talks about, in a sense, one element of a national program. So I'll summarize what the national program is, but I think this is quite an important piece of work that we are doing. So what we've done is that we have brought together a very wide-ranging group of stakeholders, and we have embarked on a scenario-building process to look at what we're calling long-term mitigation scenarios. And essentially, what we're trying to understand is what could we as a country do to cut our greenhouse gas emissions? And if we did that, what would the trade-offs be? What would the cost implications be? What would that then mean in terms of where we sit as a country? What would the impact be on our economy? And we hope that once this work is done, it's a key piece of work. There are a whole lot of other pieces of work that have already been done, that are already done. But in the long run, what we would want to do is to see this as part of an input into a long-term climate policy that we would eventually take to cabinet, as well as be a piece of work that we would then take into into the negotiations. Because it's all very well that developing countries saying, well, we want to make voluntary commitments, but if you don't know what those commitments are, you could be put into a situation where you agree to things that you don't, in fact, are not necessarily in the national interest. So we're saying, if we're going to do actions, what is it that we're going to do? And we're thinking very carefully about what those are. And then finally, we would want to build awareness and support the government initiatives, and this is quite an important piece of work. Before I go on in more detail into that, I think that just let me locate it within the other pieces of work. Because in his budget speech, the minister did talk about eventually, in around 2008-2009, us being able to produce a national climate policy. We've done a climate change response strategy some years ago, which was an overarching high-level strategy about what would we need to do about climate change as a country, and it took into account quite a lot of the science that Judy spoke about. Secondly, we have over the last couple of years, since our National Climate Change Policy Conference, there's been work done by different sector departments looking at climate change issues in their particular sectors. The Department of Agriculture has done some work, the Department of Water Affairs is doing work, but there's sectoral work that's been done. Then there's this long-term mitigation scenario planning that I'm going to talk about here. We are also, from this side, in the process of starting to update our national greenhouse gas inventory, which is a crucial piece of information that we need in order to be able to look at where we sit as a country. Then there are pieces of work done by particular provinces and cities looking at their own issues around climate change and strategies for it. And the Western Cape, I think, is in the forefront of that work, both the City of Cape Town and the Western Cape Province have done some quite comprehensive pieces of work looking at climate change issues, and certainly from the map earlier, the Western Cape, the western side of South Africa is likely to be very pretty severely impacted by climate change, so it's very important that that's done. The city of Durban has also started to look at things like the implications of sea level rise and what it might mean in terms of long-term development planning. So that work is also happening. And then we're doing something that we're required to do by the convention, which is called the National Communication, which essentially brings together all of the work on climate change. And we are using the fact that we started to work on our next iteration of that as a means to be able to plug the gaps that we've got on adaptation issues. When all of those pieces of work are completed, together with this work on mitigation, we think we've then got all of the information that you need in order to actually produce a national climate change policy and to be able to put some kind of a draft document on the table that we could then consult widely and eventually get approval for. Okay, so this is kind of one of the building blocks of that, and all this other work is ongoing. The next slide just kind of gives you an indication of all the people who are involved in our scenario building team for the long-term mitigation scenario planning. As you can see, it's a very wide grouping of people across all key sectors in South Africa. In terms of the scenario framework, essentially, what we're trying to do is we've adopted the framework on the next page as a kind of departure point for looking at different options. And the first one at the top, GWC, is growth without constraints. So if we didn't take into account any environmental issues or any climate issues or any kind of constraints on water or any kind of other resource, and we just said, we'll use whatever we've got in the country and we'll go broke on growth, that is the point where our greenhouse gas emissions may take us. Then the second scenario is, says if we did certain things, if we took existing policy, mitigatory policies that we have in place at the moment, so things like the energy efficiency targets that the DME has put in place, or the amount of renewable energy that is projected to come on stream and that people are doing work on solar wind power and things like that, and we said we'll do that. Then the second line says that was where we would take us in terms of greenhouse gas emissions reduction. The can do and could do would be further iterations of that. They're saying if you went one step further and said we're going to do something else, we're going to look at the potential not only of energy efficiency, but particular energy efficiency initiatives in, say, high energy intensive industries, where would that take us? The next one would say, what if we added transport on as a sector and said, what could we do to cut the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that are emitted by the transportation sector, where would we get to? So essentially what we've done is to look across society and economy and say, where are the greenhouse gas emissions coming from? And what would we need to do, or what is possible in order to reduce greenhouse gas emissions? And then finally, right at the bottom is the required by science. The required by science is very much what the targets that are being set by the International Panel on Climate Change. And that we duly spoke about what Japan's saying as opposed to what the EU is saying, it's that required by science target that people are in fact arguing about. So that's what our work does. Our work says what, and the way we've looked at it is in a set of wedges. If we do X, you get a certain wedge of greenhouse gas reduction. If you do X plus Y, you get the next level down in terms of greenhouse gas reduction. And we're looking at it in terms of what is possible in the thing. The next slide you can't really see in this thing, but it's looking at really the potential of those different wedges. It's come out very dark, so we can just skip it, but it's a very initial set of iterations. But I think if you look at the next graph, it shows how if you put together, it's an illustrative slide. It's not the exact figures or the exact amount, but it illustrates the methodology that we're using, where if you, for example, were to look at industrial energy efficiency, you would get one little wedge down. If you look at renewable, the impact of renewable electricity or nuclear electricity, you start to bring your greenhouse gas done. So that's the kind of approach that is being done. And the teams that are working on this are teams of scientists and academics who are now taking actual figures and modeling them. And I think that what is unique about the process is we're doing it not only, we're doing this together, it's us and industry and the NGOs all sitting together in these teams and agreeing on sets of assumptions and sets of figures and therefore on the conclusions that we can reach. Just in terms of where this process is going, we have a meeting in August later on this month where we're going to get a draft report of this work. Then in October we're going to take, which is basically, and that report is essentially the information, the data. Then what we're going to do in October is to take that data and to try and fit into those scenarios, those that I mentioned earlier, those that can do, the could do, where we are at the moment. And we're then going to, hopefully early next year, try and have a set of workshops with key stakeholders in societies, with ministers, CEOs of key companies, leaders of civil society, and then eventually try and take this into a cabinet process. Finally, I think that there are just a couple more slides. The first is how you can make a difference. I mean, I think it's a difference not only in relation to greenhouse gas emissions, but also in relation to energy efficiency and resource efficiency. And we've given you a long list of suggestions. We would be very keen if this is a list that somehow could get popularized and taken up and people could make commitments around these issues. And then finally, we want to know what you could add to that list. Lastly, there's a slide that is a slide that quotes from President Mbeki. We do indeed understand the urgency of the need to act and understand that the cost of doing nothing about climate change far outweigh those of taking concrete measures. Finally, there's just one final point that I want to make, which is that I think it is important to bear in mind that this is a global problem. That in as much we need to do as much as we can as a country. The fact is that it is really only something where we as a country can only make a difference in the long run if we're doing it alongside other countries. And I think that's why in any presentation on climate change, what you've got to do is be looking at the national implications and national actions, and then what is happening internationally, because our 2%, although we are a high energy intensive and a high greenhouse gas emitting country, we still only 2% of the international total. So even if we cut all of our greenhouse gas emissions, you're still going to sit with the 98%, and unless other people come to that party, you're not really going to go anywhere. So I think that really, for us, the thing around climate is that's why whenever we talk about it, it is nationally, what do we need to do to adapt to it? How can we mitigate as a country? And what must we do with other people? And what would be the most effective? Thanks.
Thank you very much, Joanne.
Thank you. I just think that was an amazingly impressive presentation from both of our presenters. I mean, it was so clear, it was so informative, it was so instructive, and I hope that we are engaging and I'm sure we will benefit from it. Just a couple of things that have not been mentioned very much. One is in terms of mitigation and adaptation. We haven't really spoken of carbon trading really at all. And it's something that is a huge groundswell community from the greener side of society around carbon trading. And it is in fact mitigating, also not just enabling the developed nations to sort of pay their way and continue imaging as much as they ever have done, as long as they are doing it in a way that is possibly enabling a developing nation to benefit from it, planting plantations of trees, etc. I mean, is it something that we should be raising concerns about right now? I know our minister has spoken quite positively about it, but I'd like to hear a little bit more about that. And secondly, at the moment there is huge development happening in South Africa, all over the country. There are Gulf estates going up, there are, our coastline is becoming covered in new development. Some of it really is a cause for concern, and clearly the way it is being done inevitably is contributing hugely to the emissions in factor in this country. And I just wondered, are we looking at growth must happen, and it is happening, but are we looking at enabling that growth to happen in a way that is emission conscious and is not going to add hugely when we, in 5 or 10 years' time, when we look back and we say, gosh, in 2010, we should really have put the brakes on some of the things that are happening as far as so-called construction and so-called development is concerned. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair. I want to echo the words of Honourable Tom. I think it was a very, very good presentation getting out the broader issues and then focusing down to a national and even personal look at it in the last pages of the presentation. Two comments and then one or two questions. One comment, I'm surprised. And I know that the department looks at it this way, but that you didn't articulate the actual effects of climate change on poverty reduction initiatives in South Africa more in your presentation. As I said, I know that it is articulated at times, but I think it's really good when you're talking to policymakers and so on to keep that link, because we obviously have specific goals regarding the Millennium Development or the Development Goals and so on, and all of those things like water availability, weather, extreme weather events and so on, all have the ability to seriously undermine the strides that South Africa has already made in policy alleviation. That's something I would have liked to have seen, certainly more. Second comment, certainly, and I'm glad you included the last slide with the quote by President Mbeki. One of the things I would certainly like to see when you speak about the Interministerial Committee and the work that it has been doing, obviously a very important initiative, but from that, from having all those ministers together, I think it's very important that we get climate change messages even before we get the policy plan. From an awareness point of view, from a greater number of ministers in South Africa. I think it was a Polynesian, an oral Polynesian question to the President this day, if I'm not mistaken. But, you know, it would be great to see the President obviously address the issues of climate change in the state of the nation, and see the Minister of Transport, or Trade and Industry, Agriculture, or Water Affairs and Forestry, and not just Minister himself, although I think he is the lead minister, all of that would help the public awareness, and presumably would help somewhere down the line when some of the tougher choices on mitigation are made. Those are just two brief comments. My first question is on technology transfer. I know that this is a significant focus of developing countries, particularly, I know there's a particular focus from the Annex 1 countries on China with regards to technology transfer. what if you could expand on South Africa's view on technology transfer, and particularly our views on global sort of global technology fund as a way of contributing to the payment of those transfers, and secondly on the, you know, is South Africa articulating any views, for instance, with regards to the patent rights of technology and our response to that? I have heard from other countries who are looking for certain concessions there, similar to what we've seen before in the past, say in the medical field. Second question, I understand it correct, when you work, you outlined the two-step process very well, which is leading up to 2012, and you're taking us into a post-2012 framework. Are you suggesting that at least in the 2012, I understand that, if I understand correctly, South Africa is not, as are the other G77 countries, not looking at buying the car, but won't accept them because of the historical responsibility, which is a good argument, of course, and a valid one. But whether voluntary targets are possibly on the cards post-2012, and if you could look in your crystal ball for us, are we looking, in your opinion, as we head sort of 2020, even as developing countries like South Africa are binding targets sort of that close for us, or is it just not even something that we are thinking about at the moment? Thank you, Chair.
Yes, thank you, I'd like to compare with my colleagues, the two colleagues here, because for me that presentation, and also add that there's quite a job to ask, both from the presenters, the DGG, and the new face, the judges, which was very eloquent. There's a few key points. Number one, what is the source of your authority? The feedback included the concern, of course, of the recognition, and what is the source? Okay, why this is not that I'm being, same time, but that one right to administration where these figures have a global authority source. So whenever you hear other presentations, you don't have conflicting figures. There should be assonance in terms of all these figures, and the theology, and the same issue. So that's it. It was best to take the professor and your student. It should be the same figures, more or less. It should be a question of competition in terms of analysis. I'll tell you what. I also want to say is that when you say South Africa is worse in terms of the use of the I'm surprised because, unless I don't understand, the US is going to be the 75% energy user in the world. Now, how does South Africa become the worst producer in this position? I know when that's going on with the women, those women should be loved. And that's why I don't understand the context of South Africa being the world and Nika of the world of the income system. Nobody. The next point is, you see, the Kyoto Protocol is the global forum in terms of agreement where people come together to address this issue here. But before that, Africa as a continent had its own version, it was called Kenyatta and Bamako. Now, how do you know? It's not wise that we should go back to Bamako. It's for that African countries can have a buy-in, otherwise, this thing becomes a global kite that is African countries. Yeah, behind. We have the AU and the Fed, and that's when we've got new NEPAs, and I think in order to have climate change
don't hold it to that. It's going to be set at each week. The alignment with the structure of the land, not the traffic from the shepherds. Carbon development effort. And the CDM, to understand it, was contrived in order to revive, to salvage the conscience of the world countries in the community. So we are going to meet, but then if less developed countries can come to the board, we can pay them for not the issues we do. So I'd like to hear more about the CDM, because the CDM is readily seen. You know, fading, nobody gets much about it. It is a viable proposition for people. See, because of the reluctance for the people's country, people are just walking away from it. And what else do I have here? But the other thing, of course, is that I also like the idea, the way you ended up your presentation by interesting home to say, what can we do to the small things? What can we do? What can we do in order to mitigate and keep this cost? But the last three forms of negotiation, which are, and successful negotiation, which are mitigation, adaptation, and of course, resource measures. I'm trying to find a way in which I can ask, provoke the key gentleman from source here. Dr. Mkeka and Professor Lawrence. And you know, we went to solve the very impressed with what we saw there. And I know Solis is obviously an interpreter of the behavior of climate change. I wanted just to hear the other from their side. And what they hear now is of course the new collection. Apart from the common sense knowledge that we have. Thank you.
I want to welcome the presentation as well. And under the inputs on IT country, there is a recommendation that emissions are also caused by human socio-economic activity. Could you expand on that so that we see a motherhood activity, socio-economic? And if there is that obligation, what about at home in South Africa? What campaign does government engage on or embark on to try and bring down such emissions in terms of public awareness, etc., etc.? And what is the impact of such campaigns if they're there? And what departments are involved in such campaigns?
Thanks. I'll start and then Judy will add. First, I think the CDM issues. I think it's two things. The carbon, the key development mechanism is a way that sets up a carbon trading system. And it does, I mean, I think at one level you can say what it does allow is allow polluters in the developed countries to carry on polluting, and then that money is put into developing countries where you don't have such high levels of greenhouse gas emissions. So yes, it's a kind of, I suppose, a philosophical debate around the merits or demerits, but it does exist. I think our issue around the CDM is that it's quite a difficult mechanism for Africa to access. If you look at the figures of CDM projects across the world, you'll see that in Africa there are fewer than anywhere else. There are more in South Africa than in anywhere else in Africa. And the issues around the complexity of the mechanism, the cost of the mechanism, the capacity that you need to be able to mobilize projects, and then I think also the scale of projects. There's quite a high transaction cost for CDM projects, and often our projects in Africa are quite small. Whereas, you know, in Brazil you can put together a project an afforestation project of a couple of 100,000 hectares. You can't do it where we sit at the moment. So the issues of scale and capacity and just management. And there, in the international negotiations, Africa has been negotiating over the last couple of years for reforms to the CDM system that are going to allow the benefits of that system to flow in a much easier and less costly way towards the African continent. So that's something that we are engaged with at the moment. Then in terms of, I think, from there, looking at the issues around growth and emission scenarios, I mean, I think that Judy raised the issue in her presentation around the question of long-term technology choices. I mean, I think really the problem with greenhouse gas emissions is that already there's a high concentration in the atmosphere. It's already had an effect. So whatever you do, even if you cut those emissions radically, you've got this sort of this lag effect. You've got to deal with what already has happened as well as what may happen into the future. And that's why what we do now and how we do it now is critical, because you may only feel the effect in 30 or 40 or 50 years. And that's why climate is talking in these long time frames, because it really is the question of your action today may only have a consequence in 10 or 20 or 30 years, but that consequence could be very serious. I think for us, the issues of clearly the issues of low carbon technology and renewable sources of energy, as well as clean technology, are key issues for us in South Africa, and how we make the technology choices today that are going to move us in that direction as a country. I really think that is. So the more renewable energy we invest in, the more efficient our industry becomes, the cleaner the less emissions there are in general from our industry, the better it's going to be for global warming. And in that, I mean, questions were asked about technology transfer. I mean, I think that we would agree that one of the key barriers to being able to deal with climate is the fact that there are technologies that exist out there, and many of them sit in the Western world with patents that are very expensive, and you are going to internationally need to find a way, in the same way as was done with Arabies, to try and get the dissemination of technologies across the world and in developing countries in a way that is affordable. So I think there's a very big affordability issue, and I think that in the negotiations, India in particular has spoken about this idea of some kind of a technology fund that could allow access to technology, because a lot of the solution is a technological solution, not only in terms of sort of new, completely new path-breaking technologies, but also just the straight cleaner technologies that exist at the moment. And then there are the more ambitious long-term technologies that go right to sort of nuclear fusion on the one hand, and the hydrogen economy, where South Africa is participating, and we might be better placed than many of our other African counterparts to participate, but I think we would agree that tech transfer is a key thing. Just in terms of the national work on technology, the Department of Science Technology is in the process, has done a technology needs assessment in relation to climate change. So it's done an assessment of where we sit in our economy in relation to technologies around climate change and what we need to do. And that's something we need to do in terms of the convention. And the other thing out of that that they're busy working on is a climate change research and development strategy, which they are going to be finalizing in the next, I'm not certain exactly what their time frames are, but certainly by the end of this year, we should probably have a climate change RNG strategy for South Africa. And I think then our negotiations around technology will then be given direction in relation to that. In terms of the two-track process and voluntary targets, I think that the two-track process, we have talked about the fact that developing countries need to be able to do what is appropriate for them, and that may include or may not include taking on targets. I think that for us, a lot of the work that we're doing at this point in time is intending to tell us in a very clear kind of way what we could do as an economy. So, and I think it's important that we understand that, so if we eventually are in a situation where we decide that it's going to be the right thing to say that we're going to take it, we're going to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions through an energy efficiency program, we've got an energy efficiency target, but maybe we could do more. And we need to know at this point in time that if we want to commit, at least we've done the work. So I think we see ourselves not so much as saying we will take on targets, but say we are doing the work now that will tell us what we can or can't do. And I think that at a particular point in the future, it may then be appropriate to say we will then commit ourselves to a particular target or not, as the case may be. The figures our figures come from the International Panel on Climate Change. But I think that once we've done things like our greenhouse gas inventory, we might then need to review it, because that inventory was only updated. We're doing an update after quite a long time. So this is kind of would be the standard international figure that we use. We would use those as the cutting figure. In terms of South Africa being high and other countries much higher, yes, it's true. But I think, you see, the thing is that in negotiations, everybody tries to interpret things in a way that is going to further their interests. So clearly for a country like China wants greenhouse gas emissions measures per head of population, because they've got a much bigger population than anybody. So therefore, their figure averaged out is much lower. And other countries want it averaged out across GDP because it is to their advantage. And others want it done in Brazil has a very complicated argument around history, saying you should measure greenhouse gas emissions according to historically when they, who bears the share of them over since the beginning of colonial times. And if you look at which of the colonial powers was in control where and when the greenhouse gas emissions started to be generated, then you allocate it in that way. So I think that part of our long-term mitigation scenario planning is to enable us to have an information base that allows us to engage with all of these different models that exist in this international negotiation, because everybody's trying to make a case that is most advantageous to them. So really, it is a question of an argument, and where we are filling in our own gap is that we are, as we do all of this work, we're certainly moving to the point where we have a very good understanding of what is our own circumstance, and therefore when people say we want to measure this per GDP or per capita, or we want to use another means, we are in a position to say, well, this is what it means for South Africa, and this is why we can and can't agree. So I think that it's an input into that negotiation process, and certainly. See, I think our problem is we have a small population, and a country that is quite dependent on coal. So what you mean is, what you then end up with is, even if it's a false picture in relation to the USA, we end up quite at the high up because of the small size of our population relative to the emissions, because of the energy intensity from the amount of coal in our mix. A country like Brazil has got much more hydroelectric power, and therefore they don't emit as much greenhouse gases as we do. On the other hand, there's much more deforestation happening. So everybody kind of argues the thing from another kind of perspective. Then just on Bamako and Kyoto, I think that Bamako deals, the Bamako Convention deals quite a lot with waste issues, not specifically with greenhouse gas emissions, but I think that what is important is that there's been quite a lot of work done internationally over the last few years to bring together the Africa group and to try and achieve a common position on the part of Africa in the negotiations. And so now before every COP there is a meeting of African negotiators, and before the last two COPs there was also a meeting of African ministers and a document prepared that in a sense provided the bottom line from which Africa negotiated as a continent. The convention of the parties, the negotiation meeting, the annual negotiating meeting. So I think that this kind of, we are increasingly starting to be able to draw a common African platform as the basis for engaging in that negotiation. And during the meeting itself, we would meet as Africa. And often where we don't negotiate as G77 for one reason or another, we would negotiate as part of an Africa bloc. Doesn't mean that there aren't very different views within Africa, but I think there are certain things where we've been able to reach a common African position. Okay, then in relation to the IPCC, socio-economic activities, essentially we're talking about the developmental activities. You're talking about everything from forest clearing in the Amazon in order to provide timber for logging, or in Central Africa, the same thing happening, through to building more power stations, through to the range of industrial activities. The point about climate change is there always have been changes in climate, but it's the extent to which human activities have caused this massive change, and really that is what we're talking about. That isn't to say that we can't develop, because I think one of the things that is important is that as a developing country, we can't sit back and say, basically there's climate change and therefore we can't grow. The question is, how do we grow, and what can we do in the way that we grow that is going to make sure that we don't make the problem any worse. I think the point about poverty that was raised earlier on is a very important one, and we take the point, which is that climate, the variability and extreme weather events or climate disasters or changes in agriculture could have quite devastating impacts also on livelihoods. So, for example, the rooibos farmers in Clan William, these community-based projects, are finding that they're going having to change what they're doing because of changes in climate. And you want to make sure that that community-based agriculture and also investments in infrastructure. You don't want to build a dam or build a road and then discover that in 10 or 20 or 30 years it's going to be underwater. So I think it's really responding also to all of those issues around poverty and development, and making sure that we also climate proof our investments, so that when we're going to do something, we say, what could the impact of climate change be on this, and therefore what do we need to do? And I think that's what's very useful about the work that has been done in the Western Cape province, for example, where the Western Cape has said, the science tells us this, and therefore what do we as a province need to be able to do about it in order to make sure that we don't end up with a whole range of problems.
Thank you, Chair. I think the question was more to the Tatemukwena 120 here and anything from South African Weather Service. Surely, as a South African Weather Service, we'd like to be willing to make a presentation that talks to the science. Because as Weather Service, what we do, we monitor and try to understand what we see. We're not running models at this stage. But then presently what we engage in and what we're doing is monitoring the greenhouse gases at Cape Point. That gives us really the background of what's happening in the atmosphere. And that site is one of the 24 sites internationally, and the data from that site is used in coming up with all the reports that you see, the IPCC reports. They use the data from those sites to say what is really happening in that atmosphere. So as weather service, we are in charge of that process. Again, as weather service, what we do, we also monitor parameters like temperature and rainfall across the whole country, and we've been doing that for ages. And so from those data, we can be able to tell what's happening, the trends of the temperature going down, are the rainfall going down. So we are able to do that. And we do, as by act, we are the national custodian of our database. So those are some of the things that we do. And recently, with the recapitalization project, we will be looking into adaptivity projects where we'll be saying, yes, we hear about the mitigation, but if we do away with mitigation, we're still left with adaptation, given the fact that our climate varies naturally, irrespective of whether we have emissions or what. So it will be then important for us to warn our community ahead. And we do that by issuing seasonal forecasting, three months. forecast where we said what's going to the weather, the climate is going to be like. So those are some of the things that we do. But then we welcome the opportunity to give a presentation in this regard if we get back.
Thank you. I will have another round. Maybe I could also start. I'd like to ask more around this question of adaptation. Are we winning this stage globally? And are there specific measures or initiatives that have been taken to really address the challenges? I'm thinking here, myself for some of these fourth world countries, which are much of the in Africa, what are specific measures that need to be put in place to ensure that people in forests, the sections of the world can adapt to climate change. Second, with regard to this technology game, what are the initiatives in this regard on this use of an energy part, of a technology part? What are the initiatives in this regard? Again, I will bring this one. Is there any initiative? Can you look at it for you to be South Africa, India, and the initiative to have some concerted efforts to ensure that we look at the clean technology for the future? I'm also thinking for you that can you not look at the France, for the next year that comes in the developed world that may want to work with us in sharing technology. What is the thinking around Alice and not fully dreaming of the possibility of this is the challenge that we're having with playing this facilitative role between the North and the South. What exactly is the content of what we're saying? How is the commitment of the group of services. What are we arguing in South Africa? What are the measures and what's happening to the industry to those kinds of changes? Is it also not possible for them to link what's happening in the cost and what's happening in the industry? Because one can make an argument that if we do the production of something in the WTO, which would make several countries to be able to develop and then be able to adapt better to climate change. Or even you could even put that in a negotiation thing that if you want to discourage us from using technology, then reduce subsidies. Can there not be a climate change argument that can be supported in positions that can be chosen? They don't attempt to. They do not look at the together. What can we expect from this Washington meeting? Either the Washington meeting again, I'm also in October, so that is called by Bush. And what can we expect from the new American administration? You guys are very conscious of this position. What is it that you can expect from that meeting? And lastly, South Africa is embarked on a very ambitious program of infrastructure development of over 400 billion over the present period. Have we talked to the energy mix of the infrastructure spending? Are we going to interface for Eskom to pick a role to play? Have we insisted that part of the infrastructural rollout must include in a big way cleaner technologies, solar energy, and stuff like that?
I'd like to expand a bit more on the greenhouse gas inventory.
I know at the climate change conference in Gallagher in October 2005, there were memorandums of understanding signed the Business Unity South Africa took a significant lead and talk about the greenhouse gas industry project. Obviously, necessary because we need to know what we're putting up in the atmosphere in order to determine if we can cut it back and when we can do it. I'm interested in how this, you know, where this process is exactly, and when are we looking at the first complete report on the greenhouse gas industry, the third part, how comprehensive will it be? And is the measurement actually happening now? For instance, SASL or ESCOM or Engine or the funds actively measuring now with the intention of giving that information over? And is it done, the obvious question you alluded to in a different answer early on about how we all countries like to interpret emissions in a different way. I mean, is there a set standard of how it's done? Is there oversight by somebody, perhaps your management inspector, so that there's a degree of accuracy? If you could flesh it out, because I mean, it's not something that the department is speaking about often, and it's not a huge amount of detail has been provided. And then over and above that, for granted you've chosen the major emitter, so how do you go about then measuring the small emitters, because they're numerous in number?
Okay, this time I'll start, and then Anne can pick up whatever is left. And just to start on the question of adaptation, are we winning the debate? It's an important question, and it's difficult at this stage to say whether we're winning the debate. I think that an important start was made at the Nairobi Conference of Parties in December last year, when the five-year program on adaptation was negotiated and finalized and agreed. But one's got to acknowledge that it's a five-year program, and adaptation is not about 5 years, it's about 5, 10, 15 years. And it's also not a program about implementation, it's about research, essentially, because the negotiations within the UNFCCC are really packaged into all negotiations that relate to research and technology issues, and then negotiations that relate to implementation issues. And at this stage, adaptation is still in the category of research and technology. And so this five-year program has a number of sub-areas, and it calls for information from parties on all aspects of adaptation. So, for example, there's just recently been a request for information from parties on all adaptation practices that are happening within different countries. Now, this is information that has not previously been accessible in and put together in a coherent way. So it's very useful in that for the first time, South Africa made a submission, and that's a submission that is in fact on the website, on the UNFCCC website, and I can email this. But for the first time, we put together a list of all the programs, all the things that we can consider adaptation programs in this country. And at one level it is quite an impressive list, but at another level, if one looks at the challenges ahead, you can see that we really are in early days. Likewise, there are submissions by many, many other countries on the sorts of adaptation programs that they are embarking on, and it's an exchange of information that is important. It's also the next step is for the group of 77 to negotiate for a formal expert group on adaptation. There is at this stage no formal expert group, and really the ecosystem's argument here is that there needs to be a focal point for adaptation. There's a huge amount of energy around the work for the negotiation on mitigation, but there needs to be a focal point on adaptation. So it's work in progress, and as I said, from an Africa perspective, the urgency is on implementation, and implementation requires financial support and technological support. And one of the big arguments from a South African perspective and an African perspective is that that financial support must not only be about mainstreaming. Now, many of the donor countries are talking about mainstreaming action for adaptation into development plans and programs. And we are saying that it's not only about mainstreaming. Mainstreaming means that you're dealing with your development programs and you're integrating climate change into it. Yes, it is that, but it's more than that. Because climate change is going to have the impact that requires that is going to require adaptation that goes beyond just normal development programs. So from a developing country perspective, it's a financial argument, it's a technology transfer argument, it's a whole question of access to information and exchange of information, compilation of existing research and knowledge, and then shifting the adaptation negotiation into an implementation framework. On the technology front, it is a G77 position that there needs to be what is called a global technology acquisition fund. And the bottom line here is that in order to buy down the patents, or the intellectual property that is often very costly, on technology, there needs to be some kind of a global fund. This is not something that we are winning yet, but it is a position that is being pushed by the group of 77. In terms of the work that has been done within IPSA, the India-Brazil-South Africa Partnership on technology, there have been a number of attempts to get a climate change working group, an IPSA climate change working group going. And in fact, there is a framework and a framework for that cooperation, IPSA cooperation on climate change. And that framework includes cooperation in negotiations, and it in particular includes exchange of information and best practice and exchange in terms of South-South cooperation on technology development, transfer, technology partnerships. I don't think that we are at this stage really making leaps and bounds of progress within that technology climate change IPSA forum. And I think partly that is to do with the concerns that India has about where the international negotiations are going. However, we are working with the Department of Science and Technology, which has a much broader technology cooperation framework. It's the technology cooperation framework. So it's certainly an area of focus within the partnership. In terms of the content of our facilitative role, our South Africa's facilitative role, I think the first question is how come we are able to play a facilitative role? And there are many different contributing factors here. South Africa is playing quite a strong role in supporting the process of Africa developing an Africa position. So Joanne mentioned the ministerial meetings that have been taking place. We also, within the group of 77, are quite visible in playing often a coordinating role in assisting the group of 77 to reach a negotiation position. Because in the international negotiation, in the climate change negotiations,
all positions go through a group of 37 negotiation process. So no position gets out into negotiations before there's an agreement at the group of 37 level. And that requires a lot of facilitated coordination work, and different countries play coordinating roles, and South Africa has been playing as well. I think also to say that South Africa does have quite good relationships with many of the countries of the EU, for example. So what are we saying? Our bottom line is that, I think as I mentioned earlier, that there has to be urgency. We've got to push that the pace of negotiations has to catch up with the urgency that the science is starting to give a sense of. That we cannot just hang about and allow the stalemate to exist. So we, together with Africa, to within this group of 77, are placing a huge sense of urgency into the relationship, into the negotiation. The other issue is the question of a roadmap, and that roadmap for negotiations on reaching agreement on the more ambitious emission reduction targets for developed countries for the second commitment period. So we are saying that at Bali there has to be agreement on the roadmap. The negotiations may not actually be starting, but by the end of the conference of parties in December, there must be agreement on what is going to be negotiated by when and how we are going to conclude those negotiations by 2009, so that there is no gap between the first and second commitment period. And the third element of what we are saying is that this thing is very complex. There are different countries with different agendas, different development agendas within the group of 77. There are countries with vastly different development agendas. So there has to be enough in the package deal for everybody to feel that they have got something and lost something. That's what negotiation is about. It's about give and take. And so within this package deal, there must be something for everybody. And that's why we're putting forward this package, which includes a range of things. It includes adaptation, support for adaptation, for particularly for Africa, but other developing countries, of course, more ambitious targets for developed countries, etc., etc. That's the package that is in the presentation. On the issue of the link between what's going on climate change and what is happening in the WTO, this is quite a tough question. At this stage, climate change per se is not, I think, influencing the work that is taking the negotiations that are taking place within the WTO. Though the negotiations are at quite a difficult stage. They do not seem to be making a lot of headway. But of course there is a direct link, but the negotiators are quite one-track minded, I think, in the WTO, and it's about trade. The bottom line is about trade. Where there is a direct link, I think, is probably with the Trade and Environment Committee on Trade and Environment in the WTO, that looks specifically at defining what an environmental good is. And an environmental good essentially is an array of different clean or cleaner technologies. And the negotiation there is about reducing the tariff barriers for the import and export of environmental goods. So perhaps Joanne might have a different perspective on that. But at this stage, I think there's quite a limited, there's a very much a one-track focus on trade issues. And of course, climate change is about trade and economics, but at this stage it has not necessarily gone strongly into the WTO negotiations. In terms of the Washington meeting, it's quite difficult to know what to expect. Certainly, there is a preparatory meeting in Vienna that starts on the 28th of August. And it's an intersessional meeting, and it's a meeting at which South Africa is hoping that there will be progress in the negotiations on those two tracks, both on the dialogue and the convention track on the dialogue and the Kyoto track on the emissions reduction targets. So that will provide an opportunity, I think, for the big developing countries to just assess what kind of message they would like to get across at this Washington meeting. So, for example, it's starting to become very important that
we are able to articulate very clearly what actions we are already taking towards sustainable development, what actions we're taking towards use of cleaner technology, for example, reducing our emissions. So really it's about actions towards sustainable development. I think also what, from a South African perspective, the message that we will want to come away with is that this initiative is an initiative that is contributing to the multilateral process under the UNFCCC. Okay. On the infrastructure and our infrastructure development program, I think that the ESCOM program is now kind of has received quite wide publicity. I think that, essentially when we're talking about energy in South Africa, we are talking about ESCOM. Fundamentally, at this point in time, and initially, their program had very little around renewable energy in it, but I think that is shifting, including plans to look at the establishment of a solar plant in the Northern Cape and a wind farm in the Western Cape. So I think that renewables in quite a small way, but nevertheless, they're beginning to come into the ESCOM mix. I think the other thing that is pushing that is the fact of the problem around our energy capacity. So ESCOM is now, there's talk about rolling up quite a big program around things like solar subsidizing the use of solar geysers in households across the country. So in a way, it's not through an attempt to deal with climate change, but more because of needing to deal with our capacity problems, that there's been a shift. And I think that the question then of also ESCOM, the shift to nuclear, I think for ESCOM is also very much in the way that they articulated, I think, part of an attempt to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So yes, but I think that there are also other industries. Our assessment, certainly the long-term mitigation scenario planning, is just cleaner technology, running your industrial processes more efficiently, and in the cleaner way, it's probably going to have a very big impact right across the economy. And when the results of that work come out, we'll see the sector by sector. We've looked at where the possibilities, the possible reductions actually come in. So I think that there's a lot of scope in the economy for mitigation. And it's certainly a much bigger consideration than it was a year or two ago. In terms of the global budget around adaptation, I think that what Stern's work shows is that if we put in place adaptation, if we do mitigation measures now and deal with climate change now, it's the same issue of technology choice. If you put in place a clean power station now, in 30 years' time, you will not have produced X amount of greenhouse gases, and that is what your saving is, but you've got to do it now. You can't in 30 years' time. The problem is going to be all that much bigger, and the consequences are that much bigger. So I think he was trying to look at that relation. He was trying to make other political case for action now. He was saying, don't delay, do whatever you can now, because in the long run, cleaning up, dealing with things like the displacement caused by floods, or sea level rise, or any of those other extreme climate events is much bigger than actually investing now in reducing greenhouse gases, and also in planning now for climate change. I think that's the other side of it. You say, even now, the climate proofing, even now, if you look at what the science says and then plan in relation to it, you're going to save money in the long run. So I think it's that kind of relationship. In terms of carbon capture and storage, yes, I think that there is, clearly Australia has done quite a lot of work, and a number of other countries have also. The US has also done quite a lot of work on carbon capture and storage. And I think the issue is very much at what point in time will it, at the moment it's at a research and the beginning of pilot implementation. So the question I think is, how long is it going to take for a technology like this to become commercially viable? And the second thing about it, I think, is it's very, as I understand it, I'm no scientist, but it's very dependent on particular geology.
And at the moment, there is assessment being done. SENERI, the South African National Energy Research Institute, is, I think, looking at the question of whether the geology in South Africa is such that, in fact, it is conducive to the actual underground storage of and use of carbon. ESCOM is also involved not so much in carbon capture and storage, but there's an underground coal gasification project and work that is being done. So there are various pieces of research that are being done, but at a fairly pilot and experimental level here. I think the Australians also, I think that we do have South African coal companies that are also owned mines in Australia, and they are involved in the processes in Australia. So I think we also have a bilateral partnership around climate change with Australia. We don't necessarily agree with Australia on everything, but there are a set of objective factors in relation to the energy mix of both economies and our biodiversity, and the fact that we've got southern hemisphere countries that mean that we actually have a huge amount to learn from each other in relation to climate change issues. So there's a very useful technical cooperation between South Africa and Australia on climate issues that we are pursuing, and I think that in relation to the portfolio committee study tour, it would be useful we would want to share information on that. I think that Bamako, certainly I think that's something that we could follow up. I think the other thing to say is that the climate issues fall within the AU system under AFSEN, which is the African Ministers Conference on Environment, and that is being linked into the AU structures. And I think that certainly is one of the ways, as that South Africa also chairs AMSEN next year, and I think that we could certainly also, and I'm certain, would want to look at how we could use that as an opportunity to really strengthen the work that we do around environment generally, but also around climate specifically within that AU and African context. The greenhouse gas inventory, the work is happening at the moment at two levels. The one thing that we've done is for the long-term mitigation scenario planning, the work that we've done is to model our emissions trajectory. So we've said our emissions are on a particular path, and if you make certain assumptions, where does that path go into the future? So that's more a kind of statistical modeling based on existing information. But then the actual counting that we're talking about, we are doing it at the moment. We've appointed service providers who started doing the counting work. We're expecting, I don't think it's going to be finished before about April, May next year. But in relation to the way we do it is that internationally there are what they call greenhouse gas protocols for particular economic sectors. So for example, there's a protocol for how you count greenhouse gases in the petroleum sector, and for how you count it in relation to the power sector, and we're doing the counting in relation to those international protocols, and with a small emitter, it's an estimation essentially. You look at the size of the sector, you look at its output in gross terms as well as its economic output, and then then there are statistical models with that would then enable you. You look at what the technology mixes are, you then basically do an estimation on that. It's quite a complicated process. The problem is a very difficult sector to deal with, and as I understand it, the most difficult sector is the transportation sector, because there you have that huge variety. I mean, you know, different cars emit very different, and different kinds of vehicles, and all kinds of factors come into it. So there is quite a lot of work, and we might need some more expertise in relation to transport. But I think that the rest seem to be fairly clear-cut and reasonably easy to deal with. I think those are most of the questions. I think we've dealt with most of them. Thanks.
Thank you
very
much. Want to add something, Dr.?
Sorry, I just wanted to make a contribution to Joanne's last comment on greenhouse gas inventory. The question is, where are we at the moment, and how comprehensive are we going to be? We are in partnership with DIPS to host the South African Air Quality Information System. It's the first national air quality database that we'll have in the country. It's going to include all kinds of gases, not only restricted to greenhouse gases. It talks directly to the Air Quality Act of 2004. We as SOARS will be housing the database, and we have formulated the MOU already, and the responsibilities of each and SOARS are outlined in the MOU. We'll be piloting four stations if everything goes according to plan next year. And this is responsible for pulling the data from the monitoring stations throughout the country. A company, as Joanne has said, has been appointed to help us run this process, and will be on a benchmarking exercise to Australia in October. As SOARS will be employing client liaison officers as part of SACPIS, supplying information and data to our clients and data users, as well as technical information, and there will be reports once the system is fully fledged. If I may add on top of that, what is happening now between us and SOARS, we have formed task teams between the two organizations. We've got a project management team in place consisting of members of both institutions as well as the consultants. We've got technical teams that have been set to look specifically at ICT-related issues, how do we get the data into SOARS as part of the group of the technical team. The MOU is in place and is soon to be signed by the CEOs of both organizations. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. Mukan, I think, has to end up in Mashamas. Just to say, before that said, Ron commented on this suggestion of you that we ultimately work on this development pathway in some of the countries with students from the north that may be willing to work with us. They only speak to us. To be sure that they comment.
Thank you. This is sort of jumping the gun a bit, but we are used to seeing the waste management bill quite shortly, so you should come before us. And that's really your baby journey in a way. I just wondered whether are we going to see reflected in that management of the whole issue of climate change. Is that, I mean, as far as incinerators, as far as various other aspects of waste management? I mean, have you had to look at it in a different way than you would have if climate change hadn't become really globally a critical issue? I'll be interested to see if it comes to us. On the issue of work with the developed countries, I think that we do have particular partnerships on climate change. I think that we part of the Sustainable Development Dialogue with the UK, where technologies one of the issues. Other departments, the Department of Minerals and Energy Affairs and the Department of Science and Technology have particular technology relationships and partnerships because the world has certainly take climate issues into account. And then from the US side, I mean, part of the US strategy has been of the current administration focuses really on saying solution to climate change is about technology. And they've started a whole lot of these partnerships. There's a methane market partnership and a hydrogen partnership and a carbon capture and storage partnership, which they set up in order to promote technology-based solutions to climate change. Now, South Africa participates, but wants to be very clear that its participation is not an alternative to the multilateral system. And I think that that's what one, the tightrope you have to, because in, to an extent, those partnerships are often sort of seen as this is the way to deal with it. I think that then linked to the second question around waste management. I mean, climate change is part of this. The issue is very much linked to this notion of getting the planet to a point where you've got sustainable patterns of consumption and production. So it's not only about your technology solutions, it's also about changing the patterns of consumption and production and changing the relationship, kind of where the balance of those things lie in terms of north and south. So at the moment you have overconsumption in the north essentially, and a huge amount of global resources are going into sustaining essentially overconsumption both in the north and overconsumption across the world by a very small proportion of population. So I think that really where the waste management bill, it doesn't address climate directly, but I think it addresses that issue of sustainable consumption and production in a much more fundamental way. And I think that that underlying a lot of this is those different ideas and the best interest that exists internationally about current patterns of consumption and production. And that's where we sit, I think, as a country, is trying to balance and find our appropriate place within the kind of spectrum of views and actions on that. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think this that concludes our business. Sharing with us the very informative and very challenging area of work. Thank you very much.
We were wrong in requesting everything.
Okay.
and we have a specific focus for this.
All right.
But who said it, I see?
Yeah, no, it's me.
I heard about yesterday. We were at a 5G meeting in Victoria.
We also heard about it yesterday. Mm-hmm. We didn't really know about it. One little drop almost everything.
Check it out.
The professor did it.
Yeah.
And you are a doctor.
Yes.
I'll put it in. Thank you.
Thank you.